Hardee was the only corps commander not present, but there was no doubt which side he would favor. He was already formed for battle, anxious to go forward. The vote was in, and Johnston made it official. There would be another delay, another postponement, but there would be no turning back. "Gentlemen, we shall attack at daylight tomorrow," he said. He told the corps commanders to complete the deployment and have the troops sleep on their arms in line of battle. Beauregard was protesting that Buell most likely had come up by now, bringing the federal total to 70,000. But that made no difference either, not to Johnston, who had reached what he believed would be his hour of vindication after his long retreat. As he walked off, he spoke to one of his staff. "I would fight them if they were a million," he said. "They can present no greater front between those two creeks than we can, and the more men they crowd in there, the worse we can make it for them." While the army completed its deployment, the troops bedding down so that when they woke in darkness they would already be in line for the dawn assault, the sun set clear and red beyond the tasseling oaks. There was a great stillness in the blue dusk, and then the stars came out, dimming the pale sickle moon already risen in the daylight sky. Mostly the men slept, for they were weary, but some stayed awake, huddled around fires built in holes in the ground to hide them. In part, they stayed awake because of hunger, for it was a Confederate belief that rations carried lighter in the stomach than in a haversack, and they had consumed their 3 days' rations at the outset. The nearest of them could hear Yankee bugles, faint and far like foxhorns 3 fields off, sounding out of the dark woods where tomorrow's battle would be fought. The elephant, veterans called combat, telling recruits the time had come to meet the elephant. Strictly speaking, Beauregard was right, at least in part. Buell had arrived, that is, he slept that night on the outskirts of Savannah, intending to confer with Grant next morning, but with only one of his divisions, the others being scattered along 20 miles of the road back toward Nashville. They would arrive tomorrow and the next day. Grant, being informed of this, could go to bed that night rejoicing that things had worked out so well at last. He intended to send Buell's men upstream to Hamburg. The road from there to Corinth was a mile shorter than the one leading down from Pittsburgh, and the two converged 8 miles this side of the objective. Conditions thus were ideal for his intention, which was to attack as soon as Buell's army could be transferred to the West Bank for cooperation with his own. Irksome as the delay had been, it had given him time to study the terrain and whip his reinforcements into shape, including even some seasoning clashes with rebel cavalry, who ventured up to probe the rim of his camp at Pittsburgh Landing. The men themselves were feeling good by now, too, though at the outset they had had their doubts and discomforts. They had spent a rough first week clearing campsites, a week full of snow and sleet and a damp cold that went through flesh to bone. "The sunny south," they jeered. All night down the rows of tents there was coughing, a racking uproar. Diarrhea was another evil, but they made jokes about that too. The Tennessee quickstep, they called it, laughing ruefully on sick call when the surgeons advised them to try the application of red-hot pokers. Then suddenly the weather fared, and this was the sunny south indeed. Even the rain was warm. By the end of March, Grant was reporting, "The health of the troops is materially improving under the influence of a genial sun which has blessed us for a few days past." He knew because he had been among them, making his daily commuter trip by steamboat from Savannah. Mostly, though, he kept his mind on the future, the offensive he would launch when Buell got there. He left the present, the defensive, largely to Sherman, who had kept busy all this time confirming his commander's high opinion of him. The red-haired Ohioan's Green Division was the largest in the army, and he had awarded it the position of honor, farthest from the landing. 3 miles out on the Corinth Road, his headquarters tent was pitched alongside a rude log Methodist meeting house called Shiloh Chapel. Two of his brigades were in line to the west of there, extending over toward Owl Creek, which flowed into Snake Creek where it turned northwest, 1 mile from the river, leaving Owl Creek to protect the army's right flank south of the junction. His 3rd Brigade was east of the chapel, and his 4th was on the far side of the position, beyond Prentice's 2 brigades, whose camp was in line with his own. The others were 3 brigade divisions, McClernand's just in rear of Sherman's, Hurlbut's and W.H.L. Wallace's well back toward the landing, and Lew Wallace's 5 miles north, beyond Snake Creek. It was not so much a tactical arrangement, designed for mutual support, as it was an arrangement for comfort and convenience, the various positions being selected because of the availability of water or open fields for drilling. In Sherman's mind, as in Grant's, the main concern was getting ready to move out for Corinth as soon as Buell arrived. He had long since got over his original concern, privately admitted, that the army was in great danger here. The same could not be said for all his officers. One in particular, the colonel of the 53rd Ohio, had sounded the alarm so often that his soldiers were jeered at for belonging to what was called the Long Roll Regiment. High-strung and jumpy, like Sherman himself in the old days, he was given to imagining that the whole rebel army was just outside his tent flap. During the past few days, his condition had grown worse. Friday, April 4th, he lost a picket guard of 7 men, gobbled up by Grayback cavalry, and when he advanced a company to develop the situation, they ran into scattered firing and came back. All day Saturday he was on tenterhooks, communicating his alarm to Sherman. That afternoon he piled on the last straw by sending word to headquarters that a large force of the enemy was moving on the camp. Sherman mounted and rode out to confront him. While the colonel told excitedly of the hordes of rebels out there in the brush, Sherman sat with his mouth clamped down, looking into the empty woods. At last the man stopped talking. Sherman sat glaring down at him, then jerked the reins to turn his horse toward camp. "Take your damned regiment back to Ohio," he said, snapping the words. "Beauregard is not such a fool as to leave his base of operations and attack us in ours. There is no enemy nearer than Corinth." So he said, adding the final remark to sharpen the sting of the rebuke, though actually he knew better. This was but one of several such clashes, including one the previous evening in which 10 rebel prisoners were taken, and just this morning he had notified Grant, "The enemy has cavalry in our front, and I think there are 2 regiments of infantry and 1 battery of artillery about 2 miles out. I will send you 10 prisoners of war and a report of last night's affair in a few minutes." There was a need for frequent reports, for Grant would not be coming up to visit the camps today. He had sprained his ankle during the violent thunderstorm the night before when his horse slipped and fell on his leg. The soft ground had saved him from serious injury, but his boot had had to be cut off because of the swelling, and he was limping painfully on crutches. The first dispatch from Sherman had opened, "All is quiet along my lines," and presently there was another, apparently sent after he got back from administering the stinging rebuke to the Ohio colonel. "I have no doubt that nothing will occur today more than some picket firing. The enemy is saucy, but got the worst of it yesterday and will not press our pickets far. I do not apprehend anything like an attack on our position." The prisoners, if sent, went unquestioned. What could they possibly have to say that would interest a man who had already made up his mind that if he was to have a battle, he would have to march his soldiers down to Corinth and provoke it? Sustained in his opinion by reports such as these 2 from Sherman, Grant refused to be disconcerted by incidentals. Besides, the staff officer who was best at conducting interrogations was at Hamburg, inspecting the campsite selected for Buell's army. No time was to be lost now, for the lead division had arrived at noon, along with a note from Buell. "I shall be in Savannah tomorrow with 1, perhaps 2 divisions. Can I meet you there?" The note was dated yesterday. Tomorrow meant today. But Grant either did not observe the heading, another incidental, or else he was in no hurry. "Your dispatch received," he replied. "I will be there to meet you tomorrow," meaning Sunday. Ever since his run-in with Halleck regarding the alleged infrequency of his reports, he had kept the St. Louis wire humming. Before he went to bed tonight in the fine big house on the bluff at Savannah, with nothing to fret him but the pain in his swollen ankle, he wrote a letter informing his chief that Buell's lead division had arrived. The other two were close on its heels and would get there tomorrow and the next day. He told him also of yesterday's picket clash. "I immediately went up," he said, "but found all quiet." Then he added, "I have scarcely the faintest idea of an attack, general one, being made upon us, but we'll be prepared should such a thing take place." Next morning at breakfast, he heard a distant thunder from the south. The guns of Shiloh were jarring the earth. Until then, Beauregard had not given up urging a withdrawal. Between dawn and sunup, wearing for luck the jaunty red flat-topped cap he had worn at Manassas, he came to Johnston's overnight camp for a last-minute plea that the attack plan be abandoned. He looked fresh and rested after a sound sleep in his ambulance. His personal tent had been misplaced on the march. But he had lost none of yesterday's conviction that the assault could not succeed. In fact, he was more than ever convinced that all chance for surprise was gone. He had heard federal bands playing marches in the night, and there had been bursts of cheering from the direction of the landing. This meant only one thing, he said. Buell had come up, urged forward by the alerted Grant, and now there were 70,000 men in the Union camp, entrenched and expectant, waiting for the Confederates to walk into the trap. The reply came not from Johnston, who stood with a cup of coffee in his hands, sipping from it as he heard him out, but from the army itself. The Creole was caught in mid-sentence by a rattle of musketry from dead ahead, a curious ripping sound like tearing canvas. Staff officers looked in that direction, then back at Johnston, who was handing the half-empty cup to an orderly. "The battle is opened, gentlemen," he said. "It is too late to change our dispositions." Beauregard mounted and rode away. The argument was no longer a matter for words. Johnston swung onto his horse and sat there for a long moment, his face quite grave. Then he twitched the reins, and as the big bay thoroughbred began to walk toward the sound of firing, swelling now across the front, the general turned in the saddle and spoke to his staff. "Tonight we will water our horses in the Tennessee River." The opening shots had been fired ahead of schedule because one of Prentiss's brigade commanders, sleepless and uneasy in the hours before dawn, had sent a three-company reconnaissance out to explore the woods to his front. Encountering a portion of Hardee's skirmish line, which had not yet gone forward, they mistook it for a scouting party and attacked with spirit, driving the skirmishers back on the main body. Repulsed in turn by heavy volleys, they fell back to give the alarm that the enemy was moving in strength against the Federal position. Prentiss thus was warned of what was coming before it got there, and turned his Green division out to meet the shock. Sherman, too, was warned, but took no heed because the alarm was sounded by the same colonel he had rebuked for crying wolf the day before. A man had stumbled out of a thicket into the Ohio camp, holding a wound and crying, "Get in line, the rebels are coming!" A captain who went to investigate quickly returned, shouting, "The rebs are out there thicker than fleas on a dog's back!" But when the colonel sent a courier to inform Sherman, word came back, "You must be badly scared over there." Presently, though, riding forward with an orderly to where the colonel was shakily getting his men into line, he saw for himself the Confederates advancing across a large field in front, the skirmishers holding their rifles slantwise like quail hunters, and the main body massed heavily behind them. The sun, which had risen fast in a cloudless sky, the son of Austerlitz, Southerners called it, seeing in this a Napoleonic omen, flashed on their bayonets as they brought their rifles up to fire. "My God, we're attacked!" Sherman cried, convinced at last as the volley crashed and his orderly fell dead beside him. "Hold your position, I'll support you," he shouted, and spurred away to send up reinforcements. But this is no place for us, the colonel wailed, seeing his general head for the rear, and went over and lay face down behind a fallen tree. His men were wavering, firing erratically at the attackers. When the next enemy volley crashed, the colonel jumped up from behind the tree. "Retreat! Save yourselves!" he cried, and set the example by taking off rearward at a run. Most of his men went with him, believing they knew a sensible order when they heard one. But enough stayed to give Sherman time to warn the brigades on his other flank to drop their Sunday breakfast preparations and brace themselves for the assault. They formed in haste along the ridge where their tents were pitched, looking out over a valley choked with vines and brambles, and began to fire into the wave of gray that was surging out of the woods on the far side. Green as they were, they held their ground against four successive charges, firing steadily until the fifth swept up the slope, then gave way in tolerable good order to take up a second position farther back. The sixth Mississippi, for one, could testify to the accuracy of their fire, for it started across that valley with 425 men and reached the tented ridge with just over 100. The rest lay dead or wounded among the brambles. So thick they lay, the dead of this and the other four regiments in those charges, that one observer remarked that he could have walked across that valley without touching his feet to the ground. A pavement of dead men, he called it. Prentiss was fighting as doggedly on the left, and McClernand had marched to the sound of guns, filling the gap between the two divisions, so that the three were more or less in line, resisting stubbornly. All three were leaking men to the rear, the faint-hearted who sought safety back at the landing under the bluff. But the ones who stayed were determined to yield nothing except under pressure that proved itself irresistible. By the time Sherman's soldiers got settled in their second position, waiting for what came next, they had the feel of being veterans. Whatever came next could not possibly be worse than what had gone before, and having their commander move among them added to their confidence. He had been hit twice already, but gave no sign of even considering leaving the field. The first time was in the hand. He wrapped it in a handkerchief and thrust it into his breast, never taking his eyes off the enemy. The other bullet clipped a shoulder strap, nicking the skin, but that did not seem to bother him much either. When a headquarters aide came riding up to ask how things were going, he found Sherman leaning against a tree, propped on his uninjured hand, watching the skirmishers. "Tell Grant if he has any men to spare, I can use them," he said, still narrow-eyed. "If not, I will do the best I can. We are holding them pretty well just now. Pretty well, but it's hot as hell." By mid-morning, Grant himself was at his lieutenant's elbow amid the bursting shells and whistling bullets. Brought to his feet by the rumble of guns from the south, he had left the breakfast table and gone aboard his steamer at the wharf below the mansion, pausing only long enough to send two notes. One was to Buell, canceling their meeting in Savannah, and the other was to Brigadier General William Nelson, whose division had arrived the day before, directing him to move your entire command to the river opposite Pittsburgh. On the way upstream, it was now about 8:30, he found Lew Wallace waiting for him on the jetty at Crump's. The firing sounded louder. Pittsburgh was definitely under attack, but Grant still did not know but what a second attack might be aimed in this direction. Without stopping the boat, he called out to Wallace as he went by, "General, get your troops under arms and have them ready to move at a moment's notice." Wallace shouted back that he had already done so. Grant nodded and went on. When he docked and rode his horse up the bluff from the landing, a crutch strapped to the saddle like a carbine, the tearing rattle of musketry and the steady booming of cannon told him the whole trouble was right here in the three-sided box where his main camp had been established. Wounded men and skulkers were stumbling rearward, seeking defilade, and beyond them the hysterical quaver of the rebel yell came through the crash of gunfire and the deeper-throated shouts of his own soldiers. Grant's first act was to establish a straggler line, including a battery with its guns trained on the road leading out of the uproar. Then he went forward to where W.H.L. Wallace and Hurlbut had formed ranks and by now were sending reinforcements to the hard-pressed divisions on the far edge of the fight. The situation was critical, but Grant kept as calm as he had done at Donelson in a similar predicament. This time, though, he had reserves, and he sent for them at once. A summons went to Lew Wallace, 5 miles away, instructing him to join the embattled army. Another went to Nelson, presumably already toiling across the boggy stretch of land between Savannah and the riverbank opposite Pittsburgh, urging him to hurry up your command as fast as possible. By 10 o'clock he was up front with Sherman. One of the Ohioans' brigades had disintegrated under fire, but the other two were resisting heavy pressure against their second position, 1/2 mile back from the ridge where their tents were pitched. He said his biggest worry was that his men would run out of ammunition, but Grant assured him that this had been provided for. More was on the way. Satisfied that Sherman could look out for himself, the army commander then visited McClernand, fighting as hard in rear of Shiloh Chapel, and finally Prentiss, whose division had been repulsed by the fury of the initial onslaught, but in falling back across the open field had come upon an eroded wagon trail which wound along the edge of some heavy woods on the far side. They had got down into the shallow natural trench of this sunken road to make a stand, and that was what they were doing when Grant arrived. In fact, they were doing a thorough job of it, dropping the Confederates in windrows as they charged across the fields. Approving of this execution, Grant told Prentiss to maintain that position at all hazards. Prentiss said he would try. He not only tried, he did maintain that position against repeated headlong charges delivered without apparent concern for loss. Elsewhere, however, conditions were much worse. At noon, when Grant returned to his headquarters near the rim of the bluff, he found the fugitives streaming rearward thicker than ever, through and past the straggler line, white-faced and unmindful of the officers who tried to rally them. Bad news awaited him. Sherman and McClernand had been forced back still farther. Both were retiring sullenly, fighting as they did so. But if either division broke into a rout, the rebels would come whooping down on the landing and the battle would be over. W.H.L. Wallace and Hurlbut had committed all their troops, and nothing had been heard from Lew Wallace, who should have completed his 5-mile march before now, nor from Nelson across the river. There was no reserve at hand to block a breakthrough. In desperation, Grant sent 2 staff officers beyond Snake Creek to hurry Wallace along, and 1/3 across the Tennessee with a note for Nelson, worded to show the urgent need for haste. If you will get upon the field, leaving all your baggage on the east bank of the river, it will be a move to our advantage and possibly save the day to us. The rebel force is estimated at over 100,000 men. Beauregard had taken over the log church called Shiloh, and from this headquarters he performed for the army commander the service the other Johnston had performed for him at Manassas, exercising control of the rear area and forwarding reinforcements to those points where additional strength was needed. Thus Johnston was left free to move up and down the line of battle, encouraging the troops, and this he did. Some he sought to steady by speaking calmly. "Look along your guns and fire low," he told them. Others he sought to inspirit with fiercer words. "Men of Arkansas, they say you boast of your prowess with the bowie knife. Today you wield a nobler weapon, the bayonet. Employ it well." Whichever he did, or whether he did neither, but merely rode among them, tall and handsome on his tall, handsome horse, the men cheered at the sight of their commander exposing himself to the dangers he was requiring them to face. This was indeed his hour of vindication. His men swept forward, overrunning the enemy's front-line camps and whooping with elation as they took potshots at the backs of fleeing Yankees. Where resistance stiffened, as along the ridge where Sherman's tents were pitched, they matched valor against determination and paid in blood for the resultant gain. Not that there were no instances of flinching at the cost. An Arkansas major reported angrily that a Tennessee regiment in front of his own broke and ran back, hallooing, "Retreat! Retreat!" which, being mistaken by our own men for orders of their commander, a retreat was made by them, and some confusion ensued. No sooner was this corrected than the same thing happened again, only this time the major had an even more shameful occurrence to report. They were in such great haste to get behind us that they ran over and trampled in the mud our brave color-bearer. There were other, worse confusions. The Orleans Guard Battalion, the elite organization with Beauregard's name on its muster roll, came into battle wearing dress-blue uniforms, which drew the fire of the Confederates they were marching to support. Promptly, they returned the volley, and when a horrified staff officer came galloping up to tell them they were shooting at their friends, "I know it," the Creole colonel replied. "But damn it, sir, we fire on everybody who fires on us." Such mishaps and mistakes could be corrected or even overlooked by the high command. More serious were the evils resulting from straggling, caused mainly by hunger and curiosity. When some Northerners later denied that they had been surprised at Shiloh, a Texan who had scalded his arm in snatching a joint of meat from a bubbling pot as he charged through one of the Federal camps, replied that if Grant's army had not been surprised, it certainly had the most devoted mess crews in the history of warfare. Sunday breakfasts, spread out on tables or still cooking over campfires, were more than the hungry Confederates could resist. Many sat down then and there to gorge themselves on white bread and sweet coffee. Others explored the Yankee tents, foraging among the departed soldiers' belongings, including their letters, which they read with interest to find out what Northern girls were like. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, were lost thus to their comrades forging ahead, and this also served to blunt the impetus of the attack which, in its early stages, had rolled headlong over whatever got in its way. Most serious of all, though, were the flaws that developed when the attack plan was exposed to prolonged strain. Neatly efficient as the thing had looked on paper, it was turning out quite otherwise on the rugged plateau, with its underbrush and gullies and its clusters of stubborn blue defenders. Attacking as directed, three corps in line from creek to creek, one behind another, each line feeding its components piecemeal into the line ahead. Brigades and regiments and even companies had become so intermingled that unit commanders lost touch with their men and found themselves in charge of strangers who never before had heard the sound of their voices. Coordination was lost. By noon, when the final reserves had been committed, the army was no longer a clockwork aggregation of corps and divisions. It was a frantic mass of keyed-up men crowded into an approximate battle formation to fight 100 furious skirmishes strung out in a crooked line. Confusing as all this was to those who fought thus to the booming accompaniment of 200 guns, it was perhaps even more confusing to those who were trying to direct them. And indeed, how should they have understood this thing they had been plunged into as if into a cauldron of pure hell? For this was the first great modern battle. It was Wilson's Creek and Manassas rolled together, quadrupled, and compressed into an area smaller than either. From the inside, it resembled Armageddon. Attempting to regain control, the corps commanders divided the front into four sectors, Hardee and Polk on the left, Bragg and Breckinridge on the right. Coordination was lacking, however, and all the attacks were frontal. Besides compliance with Johnston's original instructions, every effort will be made to turn the left flank of the enemy so as to cut off his line of retreat to the Tennessee River and throw him back on Snake Creek, where he will be forced to surrender, was being frustrated by Prentiss, who stood fast along the sunken road. "It's a hornet's nest in there," the gray-clad soldiers cried, recoiling from charge after charge against the place. When Sherman and McClernand gave way, taking up successive rearward positions, the Confederate left outstripped the right, which was stalled in front of the hornet's nest, and thus presented Johnston with the reverse of what he wanted. He rode toward the far right to correct this, carrying in his right hand a small tin cup which he had picked up in a captured camp. Seeing a lieutenant run out of one of the tents with an armload of Yankee souvenirs, Johnston told him sternly, "None of that, sir. We are not here for plunder." Then, observing that he had hurt the young man's feelings, which, after all, was a poor reward for the gallantry shown in the capture, by way of apology he leaned down without dismounting and took the tin cup off a table. "Let this be my share of the spoils today," he said, and from then on he had used it instead of a sword to direct the battle. He used it so now, his index finger hooked through the loop of the handle as he rode toward the right where his advance had stalled. At this end of the battle line, on the far flank of the Hornet's Nest, there was a 10-acre peach orchard in full bloom. Hurlbut had a heavy line of infantry posted among the trees, supported by guns whose smoke lazed and swirled up through the branches sheathed in pink, and a bright rain of petals fell fluttering like confetti in the sunlight as bullets clipped the blossoms overhead. Arriving just after one of Breckinridge's brigades had recoiled from a charge against the orchard, Johnston saw that the officers were having trouble getting the troops in line to go forward again. "Men, they are stubborn. We must use the bayonet," he told them. To emphasize his meaning, he rode among them and touched the points of their bayonets with the tin cup. "These must do the work," he said. When the line had formed, the soldiers were still hesitant to re-enter the smoky uproar. So Johnston did what he had been doing all that morning, all along the line of battle. Riding front and center, he stood in the stirrups, removed his hat, and called back over his shoulder, "I will lead you." As he touched his spurs to the flanks of his horse, the men surged forward, charging with him into the sheet of flame which blazed to meet them there among the blossoms, letting fall their bright pink rain. This time the charge was not repulsed. Hurlbut's troops gave way, abandoning the orchard to the cheering men in gray. Johnston came riding back, a smile on his lips, his teeth flashing white beneath his mustache. There were rips and tears in his uniform, and one boot sole had been cut nearly in half by a mini-bullet. He shook his foot so the dangling leather flapped. "They didn't trip me up that time," he said, laughing. His battle blood was up. His eyes were shining. Presently, however, as the general sat watching his soldiers celebrate their capture of the orchard and its guns, Governor Isham Harris of Tennessee, who had volunteered to serve as his aide during the battle, saw him reel in the saddle. "General, are you hurt?" he cried. "Yes, and I fear seriously," Johnston said. None of the rest of his staff was there, the general having sent them off on various missions. Riding with one arm across Johnston's shoulders to prevent his falling, Harris guided the bay into a nearby ravine, where he eased the pale commander to the ground and began unfastening his clothes in an attempt to find the wound. He had no luck until he noticed the right boot full of blood, and then he found it. A neat hole drilled just above the hollow of the knee, marking where the femoral artery had been severed. This called for a knowledge of tourniquets, but the governor knew nothing of such things. The man who knew most about them, Johnston's staff physician, had been ordered by the general to attend to a group of federal wounded he encountered on his way to the far right. When the doctor protested, Johnston cut him off. "These men were our enemies a moment ago. They are our prisoners now. Take care of them." So Harris alone was left to do what he could to staunch the bright red flow of blood. He could do little. Brandy might help, he thought, but when he poured some into the hurt man's mouth, it ran back out again. Presently a colonel, Johnston's chief of staff, came hurrying into the ravine, but he could do nothing either. He knelt down facing the general. "Johnston, do you know me? Johnston, do you know me?" he kept asking over and over, nudging the general's shoulder as he spoke. But Johnston did not know him. Johnston was dead. It was now about 2:30 when the command passed to Beauregard, who in point of fact had been exercising it all along in a general way from his headquarters at Shiloh Chapel. His first order was that news of Johnston's death was to be kept from the men, lest they become disheartened before completing the destruction of the Northern Army. There would be no let-up, The attack was to continue all along the line, particularly against the Hornet's Nest, whose outer flank was threatened now by the Confederates who had flung Hurlbut's men gunless out of the orchard and taken their place. After a lull which allowed for the shifting of troops to strengthen the blow, the line was ready to go forward. A dozen separate full-scale assaults had been launched against the sunken road, each one over a thickening carpet of dead and wounded. All 12 had failed, but this one would not fail. Pressure alone not having been enough, now pressure was to be combined with blasting. At point-blank range, with Beauregard's approval, Dan Ruggles had massed 62 guns to rake the place with canister and grape. When those guns opened, clump by clump, then all together, blending their separate crashes into one continuous roar, it was as if the Hornet's Nest exploded, enclosing its defenders in a smoky, flame-cracked din of flying clods, splintered trees, uprooted brush, and whirring metal. Elsewhere on the field that morning, a wounded soldier sent to the rear by his company commander had soon returned, shouting to be heard above the racket, "Captain, give me a gun. This darn fight ain't got any rear." Presently, this was quite literally true for Prentiss, who held fast along the sunken road. On the flanks, the men of Hurlbut and W.H. L. Wallace scrambled backward to get from under the crash. The line was bent into a horseshoe. Then Wallace fell, cut down as he tried to rally his men, and they gave way entirely, running headlong. Hurlbut's followed suit. Only Prentiss's troops remained steadfast along the sunken road, flanked and then surrounded. The horseshoe became an iron hoop as the Confederates, pursuing Hurlbut and the remnants of Wallace around both flanks of Prentiss, met in his rear and sealed him off. He could hear them yelling back there, triumphant, but he fought on, obedient to his strict instructions to maintain that position at all hazards. The dead lay thick. Every minute they lay thicker. Still, he fought. By 5:30, 2 long hours after Ruggles's guns began their furious cannonade, further resistance became futile, and Prentiss knew it. He had the ceasefire sounded and surrendered his 2,200 survivors, well under half the number he had started with that morning. Sherman and McClernand on the right and Hurlbut to a lesser degree on the left had saved their divisions by falling back each time the pressure reached a certain intensity. Prentiss had lost his by standing fast, lost men, guns, colors, and finally the position itself. Lost all, in fact, but honor. Yet he had saved far more in saving that. Sherman and McClernand had saved their divisions by retreating, but Prentiss had saved Grant by standing fast. Beauregard saw it otherwise. During 12 hours of fighting, in addition to much other booty found in the captured camps, his army had taken 23 cannon, exclusive of those surrendered by Prentiss, and flushed the Northerners from every position they had chosen to try for a stand. The Hornet's Nest, if the toughest of these, was merely one more in a series of continuing successes. Now that the sunken road lay in the rear of the advance, the shortened line could be strengthened for the final go-for-broke assault that would shove what was left of Grant's army over the bluff and into the Tennessee. So he thought, at any rate, until he tried it. On the left, Tardee and Polk were pecking away at Sherman and McClernand, but the attacks were not delivered with spirit or conviction. Too many of their men had died or straggled, and those who stayed were near exhaustion. On the right, where more could be expected in the wake of the recent collapse, Bragg and Breckinridge fared even worse. Their casualties had been about as high, and the number of stragglers was even higher. Hundreds stayed behind to gawk at the captured thousands, including one real live Yankee general who came marching out of the Hornet's Nest under guard. Two of Bragg's brigades, or the remnants, tried an assault on the left flank of the Federals, who were crowded into a semicircular position along the road that led from the landing to the bridge that spanned Snake Creek. However, it was delivered across a ravine knee-deep in backwater, and when the weary troops emerged on the far side, they were met by massed volleys almost as heavy as those that had shattered Prentiss. They ran back, scrambling for cover, and the long day's fight was over. The sun was down. Beauregard merely made the halt official when he sent couriers riding through the gathering twilight, with orders for the attacks to be suspended and the men brought back to rest for the completion of their work tomorrow morning. Much of the Yankee army might escape under cover of darkness, but it could not be helped. The lesson of Manassas was repeated. For green troops, victory could be as destructive of effective organization as defeat, and even more exhausting. As the men withdrew, a patter of rain began to sound. The rumble of heavy guns, fired intermittently from beyond the bluff, was mixed with peals of thunder. Lightning flashed. The rain fell harder. 100 miles northwest, the Pittsburgh's crew was thankful for the storm as they prepared to make their run past Island 10. The Carondelet was waiting. Here on the battlefield, which took its name from the log church called Shiloh, interpreted by Bible scholars to mean the place of peace, those who could found shelter in the federal camps and had their dreams invaded by the drum of rain on canvas. Others slept in the open, where the rain fell alike on the upturned faces of the dead and of those who slept among them, inured by having seen so much of death that day already, or else just made indifferent by exhaustion. Confidence south of the battle line that when the attack was renewed tomorrow the Federals would be driven into the river was matched by confidence north of it, at least on the part of the northern commander, that the reverse would rather be the case. Surrounded by his staff, Grant sat on horseback just in rear of the guns whose massed volleys had shattered the final rebel assault. His army had been driven 2 miles backward. One division had surrendered en masse, another had been decimated, its commander killed, and the other three were badly shaken, bled to half their strength, so that when one of the staff officers asked if the prospect did not appear gloomy, it must have seemed an understatement to the rest, but not to Grant. "Not at all," he said. "They can't force our lines around these batteries tonight. It is too late. Delay counts everything with us. Tomorrow we shall attack them with fresh troops and drive them, of course." Fresh troops were the answer, and he had them. Buell's men were arriving as he spoke. By morning, 20,000 of them would have climbed the bluff in the wake of Nelson's lead brigade, which had been ferried across from the opposite bank in time to assist in repulsing the attack against the 50 guns assembled on the left. The Navy, too, was in support and had a share in wrecking the last assault. Though all the ironclads were at Island 10, 2 wooden gunboats were at Pittsburgh, anchored where a creek ran out of the last-ditch ravine into the river, and thus were able to throw their shells into the ranks of the Confederates as they charged. Nor was that all. As twilight deepened into dusk, Lew Wallace at last came marching across Snake Creek Bridge, to station his division on the right flank of the army. He had marched toward what he thought was such a junction as soon as he received Grant's first order, but then had had to countermarch for the river road when he learned that the flank had been thrown back near the landing. 5 hours behind schedule, he got jaundiced looks on arrival, but his 6,000 soldiers, mostly Donelson veterans, were no less welcome for being late. Combined with Buell's troops and the survivors of the all-day fight, they meant that Grant would go into battle on the second day with more men than he had had at dawn of the first. Then, too, well over half of them would be unworn by fighting, whereas the Confederates would not only have been lessened by their casualties, but would most likely not have recovered from the weariness that dropped so many of them in their tracks as soon as the firing stopped. Grant had another sizable reserve, 6,000 to 12,000 men, depending on various estimates, but he did not include them in his calculations. These were the skulkers, fugitives, who took shelter along the riverbank while the battle raged on the plateau overhead. Every man on the field had come up this way, debarking from the transports, so that when the going got too rough, they remembered that high bluff, reared up 100 feet tall between the landing and the fighting, and made for it as soon as their minds were more on safety than on honor. Some were trying to catch rides on the ferries plying back and forth. Others, more enterprising, paddled logs and jerry-built rafts in an attempt to reach the safety of the eastern bank. Still others were content to remain where they were, calling out to Buell's men as they came ashore, "We are whipped, cut to pieces. You'll catch it. You'll see." Nelson, a 6-foot-5-inch, 300-pound former Navy lieutenant, lost his temper at the sight. "They were insensible to shame and sarcasm," he later declared, "for I tried both. And, indignant of such poltroonery, I asked permission to fire on the knaves." However, the colonel who commanded the fuming general's lead brigade was more sickened than angered by the display. "Such looks of terror, such confusion, I never saw before, and do not wish to see again," he recorded in his diary. Perhaps, like the colonel, Grant preferred to leave them where they were, out of contact with the men who had stood and fought today or were expected to stand and fight tomorrow. Fear was a highly contagious emotion, and even if threats or cajolery could have herded them back up the bluff, they would most likely run again as soon as the minis began whizzing. Perhaps, too, he saw them as a reproach, a sign that his army had been surprised and routed, at least to this extent, because its commander had left it unentrenched, green men to the front, and had taken so few precautions against an enemy who, according to him, was heartily tired of fighting. At any rate, he allotted the skulkers no share in his plans for tomorrow, nor did he return to the fine big house 9 miles downriver, or even seek shelter in one of the steamboat cabins. After inspecting his battle line, his 4 divisions would take the right, Buell's 3 the left, he wrapped himself in a poncho and lay down under a large oak to get some sleep. The rain had already begun, however, and presently it fell in torrents, dripping through the branches to add to the discomfort of his aching ankle. Unable to sleep, he wandered off to take refuge in a cabin on the bluff. But that would not do either. The surgeons had set up a field hospital there and were hard at work, bloody past the elbows. Driven out by the screams of the wounded and the singing of the bone saws, Grant returned to his oak and got to sleep at last, despite the rain and whatever twinges he was feeling in his ankle and his conscience. He had an insomniac counterpart beyond the line of battle. But Bedford Forrest's ankle and conscience were intact. His sleeplessness proceeded from entirely different causes. His regiment had been assigned to guard the Lick Creek fords, but after some hours of hearing the guns, he had crossed over on his own initiative and claimed a share in the fighting. It stopped soon after sundown, but not Forrest. Out on a scout, he reached the lip of the bluff south of the landing, and saw Buell's reinforcements coming ashore. For Forrest, this meant just one thing. The Confederates must either stage a night attack or else get off that tableland before the Federals charged them in the morning. Unable to locate Beauregard, he went from camp to camp, telling of what he had seen and urging an attack. But few of the brigadiers even knew where their men were sleeping, and those who did were unwilling to take the responsibility of issuing such an order. At last he found Hardee, who informed him that the instructions already given could not be changed. The cavalryman was to return to his troops and keep up a strong and vigilant picket line. Forrest stomped off, swearing, "If the enemy comes on us in the morning, we'll be whipped like hell," he said. Unlocated and uninformed, he slept that night in Sherman's bed near Shiloh Chapel. Beauregard not only did not suspect that Buell had arrived, he had good reason for thinking that he would not be there at all. Having received from a colonel in North Alabama, it was Ben Hardin Helm, one of Lincoln's Confederate brothers-in-law, a telegram informing him that Buell had changed his line of march and now was moving toward Decatur. The Creole went to bed content with what had been done today and confident that Grant's destruction would be completed tomorrow. Before turning in, he sent a wire to Richmond announcing that the army had scored a complete victory, driving the enemy from every position. His chief of staff, sharing an improvised bed in the adjoining headquarters tent with the captured Prentiss, was even more ebullient, predicting that the Northern Army would surrender as soon as the battle was resumed. The distinguished captive, accepting his predicament with such grace as became a former Virginian, did not agree with his host's prognostication, nor was he reticent in protest. "You gentlemen have had your way today," he said, "but it will be very different tomorrow. You'll see. Buell will effect a junction with Grant tonight, and we'll turn the tables on you in the morning." "No such thing," the Confederate declared, and showed in the telegram from Helm. Prentiss was unimpressed. "You'll see," he said. Outside in the rain, those who had been too weary to look for shelter, along with those who had looked without success, got what sleep they could, in spite of the 11-inch shells fired 2 every 15 minutes by the gunboats, their fuses describing red parabolas across the starless velvet of the night. They came down steeply, screaming, to explode among the sleepers and the wounded of both sides. Washpots and lampposts, the awed soldiers called the big projectiles. All night the things continued to fall on schedule. Dawn grayed the east, and presently from the direction of the sunrise came the renewed clatter of musketry, the crack and boom of field artillery. As it swelled quickly to a roar, Prentiss sat bolt upright on the pallet of captured blankets inside Sherman's headquarters tent, grinning at his Confederate bedmate. "There is Buell," he cried. "Didn't I tell you so?" It was Buell, just as Prentiss said. His other two divisions, under Brigadier Generals Alexander D. McCook and Thomas L. Crittenden, the latter being the brother of the Confederate Corps commander who had been relieved on the eve of battle, had come up in the night. He was attacking. Grant's four divisions, one hale and whole, if somewhat shamefaced over its roundabout march the day before, the others variously battered and depleted, but quite willing, took up the fire on the right, and at 7 o'clock the general sent a message to the gunboats. They were to cease their heavy caliber bombardment. The army was going forward. Grant's orders, sent as soon as he rose at dawn from his sleep beneath the dripping oak, directed his generals to advance and recapture our original camps. At first it was easy enough. The rebels, having broken contact the night before, were caught off balance and gave ground rapidly, surprised to find the tables turned by unexpected pressure. Wallace, Sherman, and McClernand, with Hurlbut's remnants in reserve, pushed forward to the vicinity of McClernand's camp before they ran into heavy artillery fire and halted, as Sherman said, patiently waiting for the sound of General Buell's advance. They had not long to wait. Buell's men were taking their baptism of fire in stride. One Indiana colonel, dissatisfied with signs of shakiness when his men encountered resistance, Sherman, who was looking on, referred to it as "the severest musketry fire I ever heard," which would make it severe indeed after all he had been through yesterday, halted them then and there and put them briskly through the manual of arms, which they executed, he later reported, as if on the parade ground. Considerably steadied, the Hoosiers resumed their advance. By noon, Buell's men had cleared the peach orchard on the left, and Grant's were approaching Shiloh Chapel on the right. There, the resistance stiffened. After the initial shock of finding Buell on the field after all, Beauregard recovered a measure of his aplomb and went about the task of preparing his men to receive instead of deliver an attack. This was by no means easy, not only because of the gallant rivalry which urged the two armies of Westerners forward against him, but also because his own troops had scattered badly about the blasted field in their search for food and shelter the night before. Polk, in fact, had misunderstood the retirement order and marched his survivors all the way back to their pre-battle camp on the Corinth Road. Improvising as best he could, the Creole assigned Hardee the right, Breckinridge the center, and Bragg the left. When Polk returned, belatedly, he put him in between the last two. It was touch and go, however. Like Johnston, he found it necessary to set a spirited example for his men. Twice he seized the colors of wavering regiments and led them forward. Reproved for rashness by a friend who doubtless recalled what had happened to Johnston yesterday, Beauregard replied, "The order now must be follow, not go." At one point that afternoon, he received a shock that was followed in quick succession by a hopeful surge of elation and a corresponding droop of disappointment. He noticed in some woods along his front a body of troops dressed in what appeared to be shiny white silk uniforms. At first he thought they were Federals who had breached his line, but when he saw that they were firing north, it occurred to him, though he had long since given up the notion that they could possibly arrive on time, that they might be the vanguard of Van Dorn's 15,000 reinforcements, hurried east by rail from Memphis. Certainly there were no such uniforms in the Army of the Mississippi, while there was no telling what outlandish garb the Elkhorn Tavern veterans might wear. Presently, however, a staff officer sent to investigate returned with the explanation. They were the General's own Orleans Guard Battalion, who had turned their dress blue jackets wrong side out to put an end to being fired on by their friends. Yesterday they had startled the defenders of the Hornet's Nest by charging thus with the white silk linings of their coats exposed. Graveyard clothes, the Federals had called them. The Confederates had their backs up and were holding well along the ridge where Sherman's tents were pitched. Today, as yesterday, Shiloh Chapel was Army headquarters. But the men were bone-weary. Clearly they had no chance of defeating the reinforced Federals now applying pressure all along the line, the breaking of a single link of which might prove disastrous to the whole. Not only were they weary, their spirits had flagged at the sudden frown of fortune, the abrupt removal of victory just as it seemed within their grasp. Governor Harris, still a volunteer aide, sensed this feeling of futility in the soldiers. Shortly after 2 o'clock, he expressed his fear of a collapse to the chief of staff, who agreed and went to Beauregard with the question, "General, do you not think our troops are very much in the condition of a lump of sugar thoroughly soaked in water? Preserving its original shape, though ready to dissolve, would it not be judicious to get away with what we have?" Beauregard nodded, looking out over the field of battle. "I intend to withdraw in a few moments," he said calmly. Couriers soon rode out with orders for the corps commanders to begin the retreat. Breckinridge was posted along the high ground just south of Shiloh Chapel, his line studded with guns which kept up a steady booming as the other corps retired. Executed smoothly and without disorder, the retrograde maneuver had been completed by 4 o'clock, with time allowed for captured goods to be gleaned from the field and loaded into wagons, including 5 stands of regimental colors and 21 flags of the United States. Hardy, Bragg, and Polk marched their men a mile beyond and camped for the night where they had slept on their arms 2 nights before, in line of battle for Sunday's dawn assault. Breckinridge stayed where he was, prepared to discourage pursuit, but there was none to discourage. Grant's men were content with the recovery of their pillaged camps. All day there had been intermittent showers, brief but thunderous downpours that drenched the men and then gave way to steamy sunshine. That night, however, the rain came down in earnest. Privates crowded into headquarters tents and stood close-packed as bullets in a cartridge box, having lost their awe of great men. When Breckinridge moved out next morning to join the long Confederate column grinding its way toward Corinth, the roads were quagmires. The wind veered, whistling out of the north along the boughs of roadside trees, and froze the rain to sleet. The countryside was blanketed with white. Hailstones fell as large as partridge eggs, plopping into the mud and rattling into the wagon beds to add to the suffering of the wounded, who, as one of them said, had been piled in like bags of grain. Beauregard doubled the column all day to encourage and comfort the men, speaking to them much as he would do on a visit to one of their camps a week later, when, seeing a young soldier with a bandaged head, he rode up to him, extended his hand, and said, "My brave friend, were you wounded? Never mind. I trust you will soon be well. Before long we will make the Yankees pay up, interest and all. The day of our glory is near." Cheered by the bystanders, he gave them a bow as he rode away. And that night the boy wrote home, "It is strange, Pa, how we love that little black Frenchman." For the present, though, the cheers were mostly perfunctory along that column of jolted, sleet-chilled men. They had had enough of glory for a while. It was not that they felt they had been defeated, they had not, but they had failed in what they had set out to do, and the man who had led them out of Corinth to accomplish the destruction of agrarian mercenaries was laid out dead now in a cottage there. All the same, they took much consolation in the thought that they had held their lines until they were ready to leave, and then had done so in good order, unpursued. They were not entirely unpursued. In the federal camp, the burial details were at work, and the surgeons moved about the field, summoned by the anguished cries of mangled soldiers from both armies. But Sherman was not there. Prompted by Grant, he had moved out that morning with one brigade to make a show of pursuit, or at any rate to see that the Confederates did not linger. A show was all it was, however, for when he reached a point on the Corinth Road, 4 miles beyond his camps, he was given a lesson hunters sometimes learned from closing in too quickly on a wounded animal. The place was called Fallen Timbers, a half-mile-wide boggy swale where a pre-war logging project had been abandoned. The road dipped down, then crested a ridge on the far side, where he could see enemy horsemen grouped in silhouette against the sky. Not knowing their strength or what might lie beyond the ridge, he shook out a regiment of skirmishers,